Hello, and welcome to the Weight of Glory podcast. This is your host, Clayton Emmer. The idea of this podcast is to explore the themes present in The Weight of Glory, an essay by C.S. Lewis, and perhaps to explore some of his other essays. We'll have to see how this goes. I hope at some point to invite some guests onto the podcast to share their insights about Lewis as well. But in these initial episodes, I plan simply to explore some of the ways in which the thought of C.S. Lewis has intersected with my own life and thinking. Most recently, on the Feast of Corpus Christi, the Eucharistic Body and Blood of Christ, I was reminded of the closing lines of The Weight of Glory, in which Lewis talks about the relationship between our neighbor and the Blessed Sacrament itself. So today, I'll share a short essay about the meaning of communion and a rendition of the song, Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence, performed by Fernando Ortega. One of the hot-button issues of our time is, should Holy Communion be given to political candidates who publicly favor abortion? Many Catholic Americans have a tendency to frame this question in a merely legal or disciplinary way. Very few seem to ask the sacramental and theological questions. What does receiving the Eucharist express? But once I frame the question in this way, I can hardly say that the Bible is silent on the matter. St. Paul speaks about this in 1 Corinthians 11, and I think the tradition is clear that receiving communion expresses a communion with Christ and with his body, a union of heart and mind on essential matters. When a Catholic serving in public office clearly opposes the Church's teaching, he makes himself incapable of receiving the Eucharist for what it is, a life-giving union with Christ's body, a giving and a receiving that one participates in without reserve. For such a Catholic, receiving the Eucharist could be considered a kind of spiritual contraception. He engages in the act without intending to express the very meaning of the act. In effect, he uses Christ's body rather than receiving that body for all that it is. It's common knowledge that those who reject the Church's teaching authority often do so as a result of the Church's teaching about artificial contraception. It seems to me that this is no accident. Contraception is an act by which we give ourselves permission not to respect the other, but instead to use the other in the service of our own interests. It might be a mutually agreed upon use of each other, but it is use nonetheless. When we contracept in married life, holding back our fertility or rejecting the fertility of our spouse, it damages marital communion because it interferes with our vocation to be a gift to our spouse and to receive our spouse as a gift in all the dimensions of their being. And when we engage in spiritual contraception by receiving communion unworthily, holding back our assent to the deposit of faith preserved by the Church, it damages our communion with Christ's body. We begin to relate to the Church simply in terms of how she might benefit us, and we cease to pay attention to how we might serve her. A public servant who is a Catholic is just that, a servant. It's a noble calling and a beautiful witness when lived authentically. The more deeply I come to appreciate the faith, the more I recognize that the service of the common good is sustained and nourished by a vibrant Catholic faith. It is the Church who fosters the awareness that in every person we discover an image of Christ, that Christ gave his very life for every human being, and that we are called to revere every life, even when it costs us dearly to do so. We must not cease to remind ourselves that our leader in the faith sacrificed his very life for the well-being and redemption of every human life. Our true adherence to the Church does not make us partisan in our attitudes, as though we had joined some club which only respects its own members. Rather, our life in the heart of the Church opens our heart to every human person, regardless of creed, ethnicity, or any other distinguishing characteristic. To be Catholic is to love and to defend humanity as such, children on either side of the birth canal are truly human. The lives of our African American brothers and sisters are truly human. The lives of undocumented immigrants are truly human, as are the lives of displaced Uyghur Muslims in China. The lives of forgotten elderly and the homeless in our own neighborhoods are truly human. The lives of those who identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender are truly human. The disabled in mind and body are truly human. The lives of our enemies and those whom we engage on Facebook are truly human. Rioters are truly human, as are police and politicians and drug lords and money launderers. And our own life also is truly human, in all of its beauty and its brokenness. Failing to see the humanity and the dignity of other people diminishes our own humanity, because it robs us of the beauty both of being a gift to others and of receiving others as gift. A kind of blindness can set in. The gift of the Eucharist can help restore our vision, as it is a sacrament not only of communion with God, but also of communion with our neighbor. Pope Benedict XVI reflected on the interplay of the two dimensions of communion eloquently in his first encyclical letter, Deus Caritas Est. Here's an extended passage from that letter. Love of neighbor, in the way proclaimed by the Bible, by Jesus, consists in the very fact that, in God and with God, I love even the person whom I do not like or even know. This can only take place on the basis of an intimate encounter with God, an encounter which has become a communion of will, even affecting my feelings. Then I learn to look on this other person not simply with my eyes and my feelings, but from the perspective of Jesus Christ. His friend is my friend. Going beyond exterior appearances, I perceive in others an interior desire for a sign of love, of concern. This I can offer them not only through the organizations intended for such purposes, accepting it perhaps as a political necessity. Seeing with the eyes of Christ, I can give to others much more than their outward necessities. I can give them the look of love which they crave. Here we see the necessary interplay between love of God and love of neighbor, which the first letter of John speaks of with such insistence. If I have no contact whatsoever with God in my life, then I cannot see in the other anything more than the other, and I am incapable of seeing in him the image of God. But if in my life I fail completely to heed others, solely out of a desire to be devout and to perform my religious duties, then my relationship with God will also grow arid. It becomes merely proper, but loveless. Only my readiness to encounter my neighbor and to show him love makes me sensitive to God as well. Only if I serve my neighbor can my eyes be opened to what God does for me and how much he loves me. The saints, consider the example of Blessed Teresa of Calcutta, constantly renewed their capacity for love of neighbor from their encounter with the Eucharistic Lord. And conversely, this encounter acquired its realism and depth in their service to others. Love of God and love of neighbor are thus inseparable. They form a single commandment. But both live from the love of God who has loved us first. No longer is it a question, then, of a commandment imposed from without and calling for the impossible, but rather of a freely bestowed experience of love from within, a love which, by its very nature, must then be shared with others. Love grows through love. Love is divine because it comes from God and unites us to God. Through this unifying process, it makes us a we, which transcends our divisions and makes us one, until, in the end, God is all in all. Part of the miracle of the Eucharist, when I consider it personally, is the astonishing fact that it reveals that even I have been invited into the embrace of the love that made the universe. Who am I to receive such a gift? And who am I to hesitate, even for a moment, in desiring to share that unmerited gift with others? C.S. Lewis says it succinctly in the final words of his essay, The Weight of Glory. It is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. This does not mean that we are to be perpetually solemn. We must play. But our merriment must be of that kind, and it is, in fact, the merriest kind, which exists between people who have, from the outset, taken each other seriously. No flippancy, no superiority, no presumption. And our charity must be a real and costly love, with deep feeling for the sins in spite of which we love the sinner. No mere tolerance or indulgence, which parodies love as flippancy parodies merriment. Next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. If he is your Christian neighbor, he is holy in almost the same way. For in him also, Christ, the glorifier and the glorified, glory himself, is truly hidden. Before this great mystery, let all mortal flesh keep silence.
Thank you. his feet the six-winged seraph, cherubim with sleepless eyes, veil their faces to his presence, as with ceaseless voice they cry.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Weight of Glory podcast. The song Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence was performed by Fernando Ortega. You can find a link to his music in the show notes. The music in the introduction and close of this podcast is provided by Jeremy Casella. Learn more about his music over at jeremycasella.com or in the show notes for this podcast. Until next time, be well and God bless.